Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Hello, good morning once again. How are you? Philip Boucher-Hayes, I think that's how it's pronounced, in for Brendan O'Connor once again today. The day after the Fine Gael Ardesh, the day after Storm Kathleen. Looking at the Sunday papers, if you're not interested in Simon Harris, then you'd give the papers a complete skip today because he is the man that dominates everywhere. The Sunday Independent has... Harris ups ante with promise of 250,000 homes. This is a kind of a picking apart of the eye-popping part of his speech last night with that 250,000 homes promise over the course of 5 years. Jodie Corcoran pointing out that just last month, Leo Varadkar said increasing housing targets to 50,000 a year was not achievable this year or next. Sidebar stories there. Most of us are unwilling to pay more tax to achieve a united Ireland. 60% want it. 12% are only prepared to pay significantly increased tax. And Paddy Cosgrave is back as the CEO of Web Summit. The Sunday Times' big splash on the Kinahan cartel. They reveal how they are laundering their cash, they say. Drug gang moves money through the US despite sanctions. The sidebar there is again Simon Harris's promise on the 250,000 homes. The Business Post. They have a story on University of Limerick again, but then the award for this weekend's You What story is below the fold there. Killian Woods reveals how there's a multi-billion euro plan to develop a major airport in Arklow, of all places. We'll get into that one with the panel a little bit later. Front page of the Mail, Leo and Simon's 200k golden parachutes. The Irish Sunday Mirror. Corrie in crisis. Actors are angry as their hours are cut to save cash. More on the Kinahans in the Sunday World. The Observer. Cameron warns of Gaza famine. The Irish Sun on Sunday, like a cat out of hell. That is on the Storm. And the Daily Star. Psycho seagulls copying humans. Creepy seagulls are keeping their beady eyes on humans 24/7, so much so that they are copying them by watching entire footy games on the telly. Keeping their beady eyes since the very early hours of this morning on the papers for us, John O'Brennan, Professor of European Politics at Maynooth University. Good morning, John. Aisling Maloney, political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail. Fergus Finlay, columnist with the Irish Examiner, former advisor to the Labour Party, and Aisling Meehan, an agricultural solicitor, tax advisor, and a farmer as well. Good morning to
morning,
all
Philip.
Of you. You
morning.
Suitably morning, windswept, I hope, folks. It really is all Leo who and all about Simon, isn't it, Fergus?
Yeah, it's all about the new energy, that's what it's called, and there's no doubt he did manage to project new energy, and there did seem to be a kind of a buzz. But it reminds me of the old cliche, you know, that you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose. The hard work starts next week. He got a fantastic welcome from his own party. There's no sign in the poll, in any poll yet, of, you know, it representing a shift in public opinion, but perhaps it's early days for that. But his hard decisions get to be made next week, starting with a cabinet reshuffle and starting with delivery of some of the extraordinary promises.
It is all about energy, though, isn't it, John? You noticed Philip Ryan's piece in the Sindo. Energy, energy, energy. It's everywhere. It's oozing from the walls and dripping from the ceilings. Fine Gaelers haven't seen anything like it before. They believe their new leader, Simon Harris, is a walking can of Red Bull.
Yes, there's a slightly tongue-in-cheek element to Philip's reporting from...
He's certainly having fun with it, isn't he?
But you could kind of see it, even in the Ardesh speech last night. I thought it was kind of cringeworthy, to be honest, when Simon Harris entered the arena. He was kind of backslapping and glad-handing people with these exaggerated hugs and handshakes. And I just found it all a bit mortifying, to be honest. And the speech itself actually was more restrained in tone. You may remember a couple of weeks ago when he was basically anointed as Fine Gael leader, he gave a speech which was widely criticised because it was like a kind of ham acting, completely over the top. There was a perception that he was kind of trying too hard. Clearly, it's part of his personality, the TikTok, Taoiseach and so forth. But if you actually analyse what he said in the speech, it was pretty mundane, except for this promise, which is, of course, just a promise that they're going to deliver 250,000.
Well, there was a little bit more than that in there. But I mean, Fionnuala Sheehan, same page of the Sindo, is also making the point that they were being promised by Fine Gaelers that he was going to outline his vision and his values, Aisling Meehan. But what we really got was, you watched the speech, didn't you? It was a little bit more like a kind of an election manifesto. There was a lot of boxes ticked there.
Yeah, there was a lot of boxes, but I suppose, like, realistically, you know, like, he is constrained. Like, he's, you know, in what he can say and what he can do. Like, he's constrained by the time. Obviously, we've the European elections and we've the local elections coming up, and obviously and trying to get back into power. So, like, what realistically could he promise? Only what it's already there in a programme for government. But, like, I was just following on from the comment earlier. Like, David Quinn had a good article in the Sunday Independent, and that was a bit that struck me. You know, that he said there was a time when party conferences generated a bit of excitement and there was unpredictability and there was debates, but now it's very carefully stage managed, you know, and that, like, the backslapping and the kind of excited, like, applauses, and then there was kind of speculation if someone had their head down, even in some of the articles this morning, you know, what were they thinking, does that mean, you know, every little bit is analysed. Well, like,
is that true, Fergus Finlay? Were they not always carefully orchestrated?
I'm just listening to Aisling there, and I read that piece too. It's a fundamentally false premise. I don't ever remember, since the late 1960s, a Fianna Fáil party conference that wasn't stage managed. I don't ever remember, since Liam Cosgrave's day, a Fine Gael conference that wasn't artfully stage managed. I have never seen a Sinn Féin conference that wasn't 100% stage managed from start to finish. The smaller parties, my own party, the Greens, the Sock Dems, they do have exciting party conferences where people disagree with each other and they take the job of making policy seriously. But the larger parties, they're television events. And the smaller parties would love them to be much more television events than they are. So the idea that we've started stage managing, it's kind of nonsense, I think.
Well, I'm just sorry on that. Like, it's not necessarily, like, they've obviously always been stage managed, but I suppose the point is, I suppose with the advent of social media as well, like, every single little bit of it is stage managed. And I suppose, and that brings back, like, you know, the creativity and, like, getting new views and getting back down to the grassroots and their views, and that, you know, the return to core party values. And I suppose just even in that piece, you know, there was another piece, we'll say,
every thought Simon uttered last night was tweeted out instantly by somebody in the party. Every breath he took was tweeted out instantly.
Okay.
It was quite amazing, the impact that has.
Aisling Maloney, in that jaded seen it all before community of political correspondents, how was this greeted?
I'm not that jaded yet. well, look, I suppose, just to pick up there on what John was saying about it being maybe slightly mortifying, as you said, and cringeworthy, I think what's happening here is, like, all the Christmases have nearly come at once for Simon Harris. He was very clear about his leadership ambitions, and yet there was this whole talk about there being a lethargy in Fine Gael, and that people were dissatisfied with Leo Varadkar's leadership, but nobody could muster the courage to get out a knife and stab him in the back. And he said it himself, I had to do it myself. And picked quite eloquent timing, actually, because now Simon Harris has a whole 12 months potentially to bed in and become the Duracell bunny leader he's looking to be. But as you say, there wasn't much in there that he said that was altogether that new. Now, look, I'm a renter. My ears were pricked up when he was saying €1,000 rent credit, because we all love a bit of money. But at the same time, that's been talked about the last 2 years. And in the last budget, they were mentioning, oh, we'll go to 1,000, and they only got to 750. So that we've heard that before. And then the 250,000 houses in 5 years. Everyone was conceding in the last 12 months, experts and politicians, the government conceded that we needed to build more than the 33,000 homes a year in order to really, you know, solve the housing crisis. So a revision upwards to 40,000 or 50,000 houses a year was coming anyways. And now Simon Harris has made this promise, but I don't think he will be able to keep it, even if they are re-elected. I mean, even I think if Sinn Féin came in and said they would build 50,000 or whatever they're going to say, X amount of houses a year, if it's more than that, there are outside constraints that are hampering that effort. And I think in that, he's made this promise now, he will be held to it. But we only built 32,000 houses last year. I mean, that was higher than the government's target of 29,000, but it's still not enough. And now we've got an influx of people coming into the country who are international protection applicants who rightly are allowed to claim asylum here, and we have an international obligation to do so, but we also have an obligation to not leave them languishing in direct provision for years past when they get their status and they can't move out because they can't find anywhere to live. So you've got, you know, your young Irish people who are on a good wage and can save for a reasonable mortgage and then can't find a house and can't get a reasonable mortgage. And then you've people in this country who are at the absolute opposite end, who came here seeking a better life, and we have a housing crisis that is just making them stumble at every hurdle.
Fergus, it wasn't just those who were in need of a home that were promised something. There was basically something for everybody in the political audience in this speech.
But how much
of it landed, do you think? How much of it convinced?
None of it. I'm afraid. I think the only thing that landed was fresh face, buzz, energy. And people will, by and large, give that a chance for a couple of weeks. But the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And energy doesn't deliver. Focus and concentration and seriousness delivers. And I didn't see an awful lot of sign of that. I'm one of those people, incidentally, who believe that it is possible to build 50,000 houses a year. But it won't happen because the constraints aren't external. They're self-imposed. In relation to public housing, for example, which is what's needed most at the moment, it's the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform that makes all those decisions. Not the Department of Housing, not the local authority, nothing. I'm in chair of a regeneration project in the inner city. It's a €300 million project. We have two sites ready to go. We've completed one phase and built a senior citizens complex, which is of a very high standard. We have an agreed master plan, which has been sitting there for 2.5 years now, waiting for processes to work themselves through. And the fascinating thing, the absolutely fascinating thing about this project, which is ultimately going to be a €300 million project, is tell me who's in charge of it. And the answer is nobody. I deal with hardworking, decent public officials all the time who have no authority to do anything, no authority to do anything. And we are working our way through. I don't know if you've ever seen a Gantt chart, but a Gantt chart is a kind of project timeline for big projects like this. Every big project has a Gantt chart. This one is 30 years long. There's 25 or 30 steps of process that have to be gone through before the government will sanction us to go for planning permission. If we get planning permission, there's another 25 steps of process. Public procurement, environmental impact assessments, value for money reports.
You're not going to take 30 years to explain this process to us now.
I will if I have to.
That was something that came up
and
this
nobody,
week.
And nobody okay. in charge.
And the great contrast, I think, that we saw in the other issue of the weekend was that between the rubric of a new energy and the fact that there are at least a dozen Fine Gael MTDs who are not standing again. I doubt it'll stop at that. I think there'll be three or four more. Could even include Simon Coveney. He said he's not running for Europe. And I see in the Sunday Times, Gary Murphy, my colleague from DCU, a wise old owl, if ever there was one, just pointing to the fact that Fine Gael has been in government since 2011. They're tired and they give the appearance of being tired. And sometimes, no matter how much new energy you can summon in a leader or in the top personnel, and we'll see some of that, I think, reflected in the reshuffle this week, it still may not be enough because they've been in power for too long and people perceive that's the case.
Aisling Meenhee was very keen to accent how Fine Gael was the party of farmers, renters and first-time buyers. Was there enough detail in there on what he was offering on farming to reassure people beyond Newlands Cross?
It was. I mean, when Aisling spoke there about her interest was piqued when they spoke about housing, my interest certainly was piqued when he spoke about agriculture, and he spoke previously this week about agriculture. He really does want to get back to grassroots, and I think he's tapping into the fact that farmers are really fed up. They're really fed up, and they were fed up before the water and all the rain and all the waterlog because the bureaucracy that's there, the rate of change that's coming in, the returns, like there's treble the amount of work and there's not the same, we'll say, rate of increase in income. And that's evident then by people just leaving the land and in terms of succession, know, retirement, etc.
On specifics, I mean, you look at
but the... He did give a very firm commitment. It was one of the firmest commitments he gave in his speech yesterday, which was that he's asked his agriculture group to bring forward a plan within the next week, 6 weeks, to act on what they have come up with. And he did mention, we'll say, succession, retirement, and he just generally referred to other worries affecting the farming community. He also made reference to the fact that they had 15 meetings across the country and with different organisations. So they're very much, I suppose, saying that they're listening to the farmers and the farm organisations. But the proof will be in the pudding. We don't want lip service, you know, as I said. And I think as well, I think there's an acknowledgement there that there's, you know, that there's a loss of grassroots support in terms of farmers and rural people, which can be seen then with the rise in the independents. You know, you see the rise of and Kieran Mullooly obviously throwing his hat into the ring for the MEP this week as well. So I think there's a very much a focus on trying to get back.
And Cormac Lucy as a councillor as well. It is notable, two people that you thought might have found a natural home in either Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil or standing as independents. Which brings us on to the poll, Aisling Maloney, in the Sunday Independent, the Ireland Thinks poll. Can you take us through it?
Yes. So just first of all, I suppose the disclaimer on this, it was a text-based poll conducted on Friday and Saturday, April 5th and 6th, and the sample size was 1,334 people, and the margin of error was plus or minus 2.7%. And with that out of the way, I suppose we'll go to the issues first.
Would you like? Go on.
So look, I suppose the number one issue for people was housing. 59% of people said that this was the number one issue. Interestingly, this is up 11% in a month. So I suppose maybe the national conversation, you want to say, has gone off housing maybe in the last couple of weeks with issues in immigration, but clearly in this poll it's back on top. And health was there also at 31% saying it was the top concern. Cost of living then at 27% and immigration at 26%. So immigration it features, but it's far from the top issue for people, as I was saying, housing earlier, but also cost of living featuring there. And I think from this government in the last two budgets, I think the feeling is that cost of living is largely sorted in as much as it can be.
And
we've seen the worst of the energy crisis pass over.
Gaza down at kind of number 10.
Yes,
5%.
Yeah, indeed. I suppose, look, you're asking people, you know, what are the most important priorities to deal with? In most cases, I mean, Ireland is seen as quite a leader in terms of our rhetoric on Gaza, even before the current atrocities there. So I think, you know, it isn't featuring as the top issue. I'm not at all that surprised about it. I mean, look, we're coming into the European and local elections. I'm sure if an MEP knocked at my door, I would ask them about it. But a local councillor and
you,
an RTD,
you would think,
maybe
though,
not.
As a conversation point, is the thing that most people are talking about, but it's way down the list of priorities according to that poll. The state of the parties then, and bearing in mind once again that the margin of error is almost 3%.
Yes. And then the movement here is very little. So look, I suppose Sinn Féin are at 26%. Down one. Fine Gael are at 21%, down one. Fianna Fáil 16%, down one. The Sóc Dems are on 6%, no change. Aintu's on 4%, no change. The Green Party's on 4%, no change. Labour 3%, minus, they're down one. People Before Profit are on 2%, no change. And the Independents and Others is at 17%. They've gained three points there. Now, as you say, the margin of error. So look, we'll take all of that. But I suppose Sinn Féin are at their lowest level of support in 4 years, and the Independents are prospering here, is what the Sunday Independent are saying. And I suppose that's really interesting.
Okay. What do you take from that, Fergus Findlay? Same as it ever was?
Well, yes. Now, I have to tell you, I'm really dubious about this kind of polling. I'm not sure I trust it at all.
The text-based polling, you mean?
Well, I get a text once a month. I got one last Friday, asking me to take part in I'm on the panel, right? I get a text. I don't know how I'm on the panel. If I'm in the mood, I fill in the questionnaire. If I'm not, I don't. I'm guessing that they have the same people that they go back to month after month after month. I know from the evidence of my phone that I get a monthly text asking me would I like to do it this month. So I just don't know.
But what are you dubious about? I mean, at least it's consistent then, isn't it?
In my understanding of polling, and I've been involved in polling for 40 years, you go and you knock on people's doors, you interview them, you take random samples. You don't set up a group of people and go back to them again and again and again and again. Now, maybe that's not what they're doing. All I can tell you from the evidence of my own phone, that's what they're doing to me. At the same time, I have to say, I mean, there's some really mad stuff in this. There's on one of the pages, there's a poll about what should Simon Harris's first priority be? And 59% say housing. 11%, which I think is the third biggest number, say something else, which, if nothing else, I suppose, gives you an indication of the complexity of the job he has to do. Then there's a poll about culture wars. Culture wars are an entirely fabricated item. Entirely fabricated. I don't know why any responsible organisation is conducting polls about culture wars.
And but apparently, people do seem to be consumed about them. I'm not disputing that they're not fabricated, but people's opinions are swayed by
consumed and confused. And this poll, if we take it seriously, says an awful lot of people think the government is too liberal on transgender issues, and an awful lot of people think the government is too conservative on transgender issues. What is one supposed to make of all that? So
there perhaps should be an option in there to say, does the government quite rightly not want to get involved in transgender issues, and might we all just keep well enough out of it? Is not a question that is asked.
I also attest to what kind of side you're coming from. I think, like, when you say if the government has become too liberal or left wing, and then that person also said that their top issue was immigration, and then if you think the government has become too conservative or right wing, your top issue is housing. So I think it is what side of the spectrum you lean towards as well. Exactly. In those answers,
I think there's the other interesting thing is the increased support again for the independent group. And the big question here, going back to Kieran Mullooly being nominated as a candidate in the European Parliament election, is when do the independent group stop being an independent group? Because now they've got this political formation. It's a kind of loose form of political party. But hitherto, being an independent, really, the advantage of it derived from being independent of party political politics. Now we're into a completely different phase, and I just wonder how that's going to pan out, because they've had a very good week, as well as Kieran Mullooly. They have two ex-Fianna Fáil councillors that are going to run in Galway, and that's very important for them. They have clear momentum.
And I think there's more to come. There's been a couple of Fianna Fáil councillors who've stepped down, who you're questioning kind of when are they going to make the declaration for independence Ireland, and how quickly Michael Collins and Richard O'Donoghue can get on the phone to them. So that's going to be very interesting. I actually think that they could form a big player potentially in the next Dáil, and then potentially in a coalition, because I think the game plan here for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael is to play nice for the next year. They're not going to go into an election pact, but I think they both know that they're leaning towers on each other. And the question really is then who's going to substitute for the Greens. I don't think the Greens are in quite as much cohesion as Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. The reality is the poll does show,
insofar as one can take it seriously, the poll does show a fairly clear majority in favour of the return of the present government, the present composition.
And in fairness to the poll, I think it can be taken seriously that this method of polling hasn't been that far out in the past. Can I draw your attention to the piece below this polling analysis? Jodie Corcoran's suggesting that a shift to the right by Harris could shore up support. Who read that piece?
I did.
Go on, Aisling.
I thought it was a great piece. Basically, he was mentioning that, yeah, it was like, I suppose, a return to the core party values. And he made reference, like, that in the speech, I suppose, he did cover the core party values, you know, but he said they were a little more conservative than the core values outlined on their website, which also referred to things like integrity, hope, compassion, personal liberty. And that comes back to, you know, you have the liberal agenda and you have perhaps the woke agenda. And the liberal agenda, you know, like focus on marriage equality and abortion. The woke agenda, arguably, you know, is being driven by academics and NGOs, you know, make reference to the two referendums. You can make reference to the hate speech bill. And, you know, it's all quite populist. No party, I think, is grasping the middle class vote at the moment. And I think that Simon Harris has acknowledged that. And I think he's well aware of that. You know, Michael Fitzmaurice came out during the week. He described Kieran Mullooly as a straight shooter. He has good knowledge of rural Ireland and agriculture. And, you know, he's worked in a couple of different industries. Okay. So I think the independents are going to give him a real run for their money.
Fergus Findlay, your neck pivoted through 180 degrees there. Why was that?
I don't understand the reference to liberal agenda versus woke agenda. I just don't understand where support for greater equality ends and some kind of mad campaigning for I don't know what begins. I've never understood the meaning of the term woke other than as a term of abuse. And this piece, and there's another piece by David Quinn, which talks about the power of NGOs and how government listens to NGOs. Mm-hmm. And I worked for an NGO for 15 years. For every day of every week of those 15 years, I campaigned on the subject of child poverty. Didn't make any impact whatsoever.
David Quinn's piece is suggesting that the NGOs are effectively some kind of a deep state and actually setting the government's agenda for them.
Which I think is absolute nonsense and palpably untrue and demonstrably untrue.
Ashling, me and you like that
piece. Yeah, I want to go back because like I think like the difference is to me is realism. And there was, you know, I'll refer
you to... The difference between liberal and woke, you mean?
Yeah, is realism, you know. Going back to the piece, like there was a piece with David Quinn, you know, and he said... he made reference to Charlie Flanagan. He said, I've said to colleagues that I would have more influence in government policy if I was a middle-ranking official with an NGO than I have as a government backbencher, and I regret that. So, you know, and then David Quinn made reference to three different examples. He made reference to the National Women's Council of Ireland, which is exclusively state-funded. He made reference to lobby groups that represent asylum seekers and then green policies. And then he finishes by saying, if Simon Harris has any sense at all, he will listen to his if he has any sense at all, he will listen to his special advisors and the NGOs less and to his party rank and file more. He
NGOs
needs to start listening to people more.
It's just the, like, I mean, if we're going to develop a policy around domestic violence, I want Women's Aid to have a say. Like, they're the experts. And I mean, they are. They represent the women. They're the people talking to the people on the ground. And I'm just using them as one example of an NGO. And I'm sure people will come back to me with all sorts of, oh, well, this NGO is bogus and this. But like, these are the people on the ground. As you said, Fergus, if you're campaigning for child poverty, you're visiting, you know, youth centres and places where those children are.
Hang on a second. Let me frame it another way to you, Aisling. Meehan. Should the IFA and the ICMSA not be consulted on matters agricultural?
No, and that's why I want to come back in and just clarify that it has to be a collaborative approach. And I say it, and my hand firmly in the air, I spoke at a Fine Gael conference there before Christmas, and because they brought me in as an agri advisor with a legal and tax background to give my experience of like what's happening on the ground in terms
and
of...
And on that particular issue and the issues like succession, you're saying your expertise is more appropriate than having the IFA or the ICMSA
NGO. No, it's an absolute collaborative approach. So like I come to these things, I'm a farmer, I'm farming in my own right. I also meet families on a daily basis.
You're saying that the government should
collaborate. You have to draw experience. Yeah.
You're saying the government should collaborate with the IFA and other bodies who have a huge vested interest in this area, but shouldn't collaborate with the National Women's Council.
No, I'm absolutely not saying that. I'm absolutely not saying that. I'm saying, what I'm saying is that you have to take a collaborative approach in that you have to listen to the people on the ground. So you have to listen to the farmers. But like the IFA doesn't represent every farmer in the country, like not all, you know, farm organisations, but you have to take a collaborative approach. It's going back to your survey that you referred to at the start, you know, that you have to, you take a survey of people, but like you have to get different stakeholders together. And I've seen that work really effectively.
So collaboration, there's nothing wrong then with collaboration with the National Women's Council, who have 40 years of experience of representing.
Oh, absolutely.
It's not woke.
I don't want you to misrepresent what I'm saying. What I was reading from was an article from David Quinn where he highlighted a couple of different... The point I was making is that they're listening too much to special advisors and NGOs, that they need to take a more collaborative approach. That was the point I was making.
John O'Brien?
Well, the really interesting absence from the speech last night was climate change. He said virtually nothing about climate change. Many of the people in Ireland will have watched the wonderful documentary that you made with colleagues in recent weeks. I was astonished. You may have seen that farmers have been protesting in Brussels basically since the start of the year. There's been a permanent smell of manure right through the centre of Brussels. And the European Commission has completely caved into the farmers. Ursula von der Leyen, she put at the centre of her programme in 2019 the European Green Deal. It has been completely gutted.
I'm not so sure farmers you can say that though, John, because they didn't do an assessment of what the impact would be before they said we're going to roll back on some of these proposals. So it's not really known if freeing up farms under 10 hectares from inspections is actually a filleting of the Green New Deal or not.
We do know that she got rid entirely of the pesticides legislation that they were processing. The European Green Deal has been almost completely gutted. There's virtually nothing left because the European People's Party, of which Fine Gael is part, is desperately fearful of farmers.
So what you're saying is you want to hear Simon Harris's big picture and vision on climate, on environment and how it intersects with farming.
Absolutely. And there was nothing of that there. What we got instead was this pandering to the farming community. Around Europe, only 2% of the population works in agriculture. And yet, 30% of the EU budget still goes to the agricultural sector. It's extraordinary.
But eating is pretty important as well, though, isn't it? Aisling Meehan, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, he referred to the fact that there's a climate emergency. But like what he was saying was that he won't talk down. He's not going to talk down to farmers or to people. Like you won't fixed by lecturing, by dividing people. And it comes back to this collaborative approach. It's like helping people to bring about practical changes. And I just want to bring in there, I read another article in one of the papers yesterday. It was a report by Kevin O'Sullivan, The Times yesterday, that 57 large multinationals are responsible for 80% of greenhouse gas emissions. And that data, the data confirms that it's business as usual, collective mindset, yet another indication of global decarbonisation not happening at the scale required. We as farmers absolutely recognise that there is a climate emergency there. We are doing what we can in order to address that. And we're being spoken down to on a daily basis and we're fed up with it. We're just honestly fed up with it. So I think that's what Simon Harris was. He did mention the climate emergency in the speech, but what he is saying is that he's listening to farmers saying we are fed up of being preached at all the time. Okay. We're doing our bit. At the same hand, it was just really frustrating to read that yesterday. Then on the other hand, the global players, are they doing their bit? And like we will do our bit whether they're doing it or not. But I think there has to be an acknowledgement that there's more people at the table.
Aisling Maloney.
I think that's the frustrating thing here for farming communities is that you're laying out all of the issues there, Aisling, and especially in relation to you say you know they understand the climate crisis is real. You're actually facing it on the front line with the fodder crisis. So, but then you have on the other end of this, you mentioned it at the start there that there's a Middle East consortium looking to build an airport.
We'll come to this.
This is the juxtaposition that people get really frustrated with, and also this is where Simon Harris faces an issue because he has to shore up the Fine Gael rural vote, and they're seen to have kind of lost that.
Okay.
And he was doing a lot of that flag waving in the speech last night.
But
there was a climate change section, just to point out. I'm aware, I understand that there was a longer climate change section.
They
in
cut
the speech,
it out,
but they cut it out for time reasons. Now you can read into that what you want.
Okay. It has to be said, and I'm full of admiration for everything you just said, Aisling, about individual farmers doing their bit and so on. The voice of the farming community is the IFA, and the IFA's basic position on climate change is we'll do our bit eventually. We will be holy, but not yet. That's the frustration for everybody.
It might
else.
Be, but I think wouldn't what Aisling what Aisling Meehan is identifying there, though, Fergus, is that while the IFA and the ICMSA might be very powerful organisations and institutions, the individual farmers who are struggling with a huge amount of red tape and struggling with weather and price and everything else are feeling very put upon.
Yes.
Because they have done, frankly, a hell of a lot more than anybody else sitting around this table.
And I'm just going to say, I've been at IFA meetings where you have like the policy makers and like they do presentations, they give presentations, and the rate of change that they're dealing with is phenomenal. Like the change that's coming in and like all
nobody else's business changes as frequently the regulations surrounding it as theirs does.
No, I sympathise with that and I agree with that, and I particularly agree with the thing about red tape. And you look at what's happening to farmers this year, just now. As a direct consequence of climate change, they're facing probably the biggest harvest crisis that they're ever likely to face. There are things that need to be harvested that haven't been planted yet because of the weather.
An airport for Arklow, a cabinet reshuffle, and the cost of Northern Ireland and unification after this.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Before we move on from the Duracell Bunny Taoiseach or the TikTok Taoiseach or whatever you want to call him, there is a reshuffle on the cards now. Fergus, if you were advising him on a reshuffle, what do you think he should do?
I would advise him to concentrate on stability, to look for experience, to look for performance, to demand performance.
Absolutely.
Sorry, Philip. If he, the worst thing he could do now and is appoint completely inexperienced people to top jobs.
Okay. Now Aisling Maloney.
He's going to have to do some of that.
Interest me here. Tell me what he could do that would be novel and new.
Okay, so look, so we have his own job is up for grabs, and then obviously Simon Coveney, who's the Business and Enterprise Minister, has stepped down. So we've got further and higher education and business and enterprise top, you're talking about full ministries are vacant. So who is he going to put where? And we're talking about whether he could move people around. It seemed to be that Heather Humphreys is going to stay in her position in social protection. She's obviously now the deputy leader of Fine Gael.
And not go to justice?
Yes, well, this is something that's been talked about, but John Lee in the Irish Daily or in the Irish Mail on Sunday today, my political editor, writing that Helen McEntee's job is actually seen to be safe. And I think this is something what you're touching on there, Fergus, about stability, because what we have now is kind of a period of stability within Fine Gael. There was no backstabbing for this top role. There was no contest where people got scratched. So
Jennifer Carroll McNeill did put her hat in the ring. Is she possibly going to be excluded?
Well, there you go. I mean, is there a price to pay for over ambition potentially? But she, I mean, this idea about experience, I mean, she's been around the block in government. She was a government advisor. I mean, she knows the ins and outs of it. But to move Helen McEntee, let's say, from justice with only 12 months to go, is that wise? How much of an effect is a new person going to have? And some of the issues in justice, I suppose Helen McEntee, we know, has made missteps with her walk around Talbot Street, flanked by two Gardaí in the summer last year after an attack on a tourist. But at the same time, you know, to move her out for 12 months to go when they just defended her in a confidence motion in December, would that not look like backtracking on what you said a couple of months ago?
That would be a culture war statement if you were to do that. By the way, I don't let the moment pass without simply saying that only a woman would be described as overambitious for looking for the top job.
Well, no, I'm not saying she's overambitious. No, I'm saying that
Philip
is being said.
Did. I did not say it. I asked the question, was she going to be punished
but
for
I
her
think,
ambition?
But I think, I mean, it's really not without...
Trying to get me cancelled.
For Jennifer
bringing the culture wars into this studio. Yeah. Get out.
For Jennifer
I'm determined to be woke, okay? Yeah, I'm the woke champion.
It's really
here.
Not seen as that far cry of possibility in any shape of the mind. I mean, people have talked to me even way before we had this question about Leo Varadkar's vacancy, that she was seen as a completely credible candidate for the top job. Maybe not right now, but at some point. So, like, I'm not saying she's overambitious from many stretch of the mind. I think she's very much impressed her
colleagues. Oh, everybody's backpedalling now.
Look, I suppose, Helen McEntee looks like she might stay in justice from what John Lee is reporting, but then there's going to be people who are promoted, Peter Burke seen as a candidate, and Jennifer Carroll McNeill. However, geography will come into it. Will Patrick O'Donovan from Limerick be promoted? But obviously there's been some issues between him and Harris, so maybe that will come into
it
as well.
Front page of the Sunday Business Post, Killian Wood's story about an airport for Arklow. Who read this?
I did.
Aisling Maloney.
And I said, excuse me? So Killian Wood's reporting on the front of the Business Post that a Middle Eastern investment consortium is planning on advancing ambitious plans to build an international airport in Wicklow after agreeing provisional plans with local farmers and families to buy more than 600 acres of land. And I know this is in the context, for people listening, that we've been talking about the cap on Dublin Airport being lifted. But of course, the green side of the government waving the flag here, saying absolutely not, we have climate targets to meet, we can't be doing that now. And you have the other side of the coalition saying, well, we kind of need to for business purposes, and if we don't have the flights coming into Dublin, they won't just go out of Dublin and go to Shannon, they'll go somewhere else, different country.
Aisling, me and you'd have a good idea about how hard it might be to get 10 families with contiguous plots of land totalling 1,000 acres, which is what they say they need, to all agree to sell at the same time.
Strangely enough, it's doable, because we act for a lot of landowners that are given option agreements over their lands for solar farms. And realistically now, because of the grid capacity issue, they're having to build substations. So for the farms to be viable, they have to pull together maybe 750, 850 acres.
There's a difference between a 30-year lease on a solar farm and a runway, which is going to be there in perpetuity.
Yeah, but then the other side of it is, like, you get a rent for the solar farm. You know, it's an option, it's a lease, and you're very restricted in what you can do with that land for the 30, 35-year period. And there's a lot of kind of unknowns, and you're going to get the land back at some point in the future. Whereas if you sell the land, you can pocket the money, straight away. So like I would see, you know, certain landowners, if they're selling land for a substation, they get over the odds and it's like the Live PGA, show me the money if you pay me enough, potentially.
Well, exactly like that.
On the subject...
Show me the carbon emissions.
Exactly. On the subject of money, it seems everybody wants a United Ireland, but nobody wants to pay for it. Back to that poll in the Sunday Independent, 12% prepared to pay significantly higher taxes, 60% in favour of a United Ireland. Are the numbers here muddying the waters, do you think, John O'Brennan?
Well, firstly, this issue has come to the surface this week because of an important report by two very respected economists, Professors John Fitzgerald and Ergun Morgenroth of the ESRI. And their projection is that a United Ireland would cost about 20 billion euros per annum subsequent to it being achieved. Now,
with a lot of assumptions built into that figure.
Exactly. It has a lot of caveats attached to it. There have been other pieces of research completed over the last few years, notably one under the Aarons Project, which is a project that is trying to scope out what a United Ireland might mean, what work needs to be done, and so forth. And some of those projections are vastly less, one of them at about 3 billion euros per year. Now, a lot of this comes down to the nature and the outcome of the negotiation that will eventually take place.
Do we take on the national debt or a portion of the national debt?
Exactly.
Do we take on, or does the UK take on, the pensions cost? Do we pay them, their civil servants, at the same rate as they are in the South?
Yeah, the pension entitlements and where that would eventually go, I think, is absolutely crucial. I know that...
But your point is that as long as all of that is up in the air and until it is agreed, any of these numbers are really just, think of a number, any number.
They're highly speculative. The closest example I think that we can look to is what happened in Germany after the Berlin Wall came down in 1990. At the end of the 1990s, the West German government essentially was paying about 1 trillion Deutschmarks a year in subvention to bring the old East Germany up to Western standards. It was about 400 billion a year in euro terms. Mm-hmm. Now, if you do the extrapolations, it sort of comes out close to what John Fitzgerald and Ergun Morgenroth are saying. Northern Ireland is very different from East Germany. The industrial base is different. But look, whatever is going to happen, it is going to be expensive. And we have to get used to the idea that if we want a United Ireland, we have to be prepared to subvent it properly.
Fergus?
Well, I don't think the money will be as big as that, but there will be a cost to United Ireland. Absolutely no doubt about that. I think every Irish government since the... certainly since in the last 30 years, has operated on the basis that if there is ever to be a United Ireland, it will come about on the basis of a negotiated settlement involving the people of Northern Ireland, involving the people of the UK, the government of the UK and so on, which makes it markedly different from East German unification. There was no one to negotiate with in that case. West Germany just had no choice but to take on the entire bill. I think there will be an element of a shared bill. But oddly enough, I think at the end of the day, nothing will be put to the people of either jurisdiction, I think, until we know exactly what the story is. And I think some of the other issues that we never even think about now might end up being more emotive, more complicated than the money.
Do you mean like the flag? The national anthem. What are we going to call it?
Yeah, what are we going to call it? Who's going to run the Gardaí? Mm-hmm. What happens to, a million Protestants who don't want to be part of a United Ireland? What do we make a federal arrangement? How do we negotiate all this? And they're much bigger issues, in my view, than the money.
Well, not according to this poll, which gives a really interesting insight.
But the poll only asks about money. I'd say if you conducted a poll about the flag, how would you feel about the red hand of Ulster and the Irish flag? You'd get very fascinating answers. How would you feel about Ireland joining the Commonwealth as part of the price? You know, you could poll an awful lot of questions that would stir an awful lot of emotions. But the bottom line is there won't be a United Ireland unless it's a negotiated and agreed United Ireland.
And I don't think the UK would be, the British would be doing a settlement that was very kind to us, because then it would just encourage the Scots to look for the same. So, you're talking about the settlement there. Actually, that might be quite arduous. You know, that might be quite difficult.
But think of Brexit. Britain leaving the EU. The EU had to drive a hard bargain, but didn't want to, be savage.
Crippled,
But it's highly likely we will also have significant financial support from the European Union, because it would be a huge sure. win for the EU to achieve peacefully Irish unification. And I assume there'll be financial support from the United States. All of that will, I suspect, moderate the amount of money that unification
plus the good costs. News story, the foreign direct investment that would inevitably end up being attracted as well. I mean, that again is another unknowable, but it yeah. would be a very significant element of the
and
financial
the question pay-up. There was, would you pay significantly higher taxes? But like, it's kind of like, when are we going to have this conversation, and in what state will their yeah, economy yeah, be yeah, yeah. our economy be and the North's economy be when we have that conversation? Okay. If it's a time of prosperity, then this mightn't be as big an issue for people. But as you say, those culture questions, let's call them, about the flag, what you call the, I think they, whenever we have this conversation and whenever the question is posed to us, I hope it happens when I'm in my career, but I think it would be very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, there'll have to be an entirely new constitution, for example. Mm. Who's going to write that? Who's going to agree that? Who's going to vote on it? Who's going to negotiate it?
We might be due one of those anyway. You've also been looking, Fergus, at the issue of political stability, I suppose, as it arises within the DUP. And Deirdre Heenan has a piece under the heading, Continuity Leader Robinson has battle on hands to hold a divided DUP together.
Yeah, and we're going to see that work out in local elections very soon, and in the British general election, which I think will probably happen before any general election here. I think the DUP have been hugely damaged by this, hugely damaged. There is now no recognisable. I mean, I've never seen in my entire life, I have never seen someone disappear off the face of the earth the way Geoffrey Donaldson disappeared. He's a non-person. It's like something from Soviet times. He just has ceased to exist in any political sense. But the vacuum that has been left behind is extraordinary. It's enormous. And I think there is an existential threat now. Should I shed any tears? I don't know. But I think there is an existential threat facing the DUP now, which I think will manifest itself in huge losses in the next electoral contests.
At a time when Sinn Féin is ramping up, you know.
Yeah.
John O'Brien, do you want to come in on that?
Well, I mean, I was astonished when those revelations came in about the Donaldson affair. It was extraordinary. I'd never, like Fergus, I'd never seen anything like this in my life.
And but why does that necessarily lead to the implosion of the DUP? I mean, it is a well-established, well-oiled political machine. Can it not handle a succession?
Well, I think it is, like Fergus, I think it's doubtful. One of the things we've seen happen almost immediately was that some people in the DUP were seeking to use the scandal to try and reopen the Windsor framework that had been agreed. They're associated exclusively with Geoffrey Donaldson, trying to blame him entirely for what they see as a very unwelcome development. And they will go on doing what they're doing, but the effect of it is going to be internecine warfare potentially within the DUP. Some suggestions that Edmund Poots is going to come back after they had got rid of him. So like Fergus, I agree that the months ahead are going to be pretty dreadful. And I think there are other things that may come out of this. For example, years and years ago, people will remember something called the Kinkora boys' home scandal. And I suspect that a lot of the stuff that was buried under the carpet that has okay. nothing to do with Geoffrey Donaldson, but that might re-emerge because the context is a very similar and sinister one.
All right, plenty more to talk about after this break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Aisling Meehan, the situation that many farmers find themselves in would lead you to believe that the papers would be full of farming today, but they're not. It's notable by its absence, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, Philip. I suppose we're hoping that we might get some break in the weather. I know that the fodder committee had met last week. That's met up with various stakeholders at looking at, we'll say, the crops and
we're told by the Department of Agriculture that there was going to be no money for fodder, and then Martin Hayden comes out through the week and says, "Well, no, there will be."
Yeah, well,
so which is it?
Well, what he did say is, like, he said that it's a moving feast. He said if the weather doesn't improve, that a fodder scheme might be available. I think there's an acknowledgement here, like, there is grass there, but you just can't let the animals out. And that's causing, loads of additional work on farms. I suppose we're at a stage, Philip, where, especially, on the likes of, livestock farms, dairy farms particularly, have had a really busy spring, calving down cows. And like normally you kind of go right April, light at the end of the tunnel, out you go. And then May, it's breeding season. And you take a couple of weeks kind of reprieve, not that you not stop working, but at least you get a week before. Whereas you've no, there's no reprieve. You're still like bedding cows, feeding animals. Now cows have started breeding in sheds. That's given rise to, there's like, you know, health difficulties. So there's a myriad of problems there. So like, and we've no control over the weather, but like, I suppose in the media or even on social media, a lot of farmers are asking other people, just, you know, don't be alone. We're all facing the same thing. Just talk about it. What's the opposite of depression, which is expression. And please talk and share your problems, and just even getting it off your chest should help. So that was the main thing that came out this week.
Can I turn everybody's attention to Gaza, please? Alison O'Connor has a piece in the Sunday Times under the headline, "We've reached a tipping point, but time will tell if Israel can cycle back on its rage." Fergus, you read this piece.
I did, and I thought it was a very good piece. And I'm not disrespecting Alison at all when I say this piece could have been written at any time in the last 8 weeks. We've reached tipping point after tipping point after tipping point. You have a situation now where one country is allowing another country to starve to death. And the rest of the world is, we're all wringing our hands and saying how awful, how dreadful. I would love to be able to say there's a way of stopping this. I wish I could find that way. I certainly think, as far as Ireland is concerned, and I don't want to be cast as somebody who's anti-Israel, because I'm by no means anti-Israel, but I think we, as a country, have to review our relationship with that state now. I think we have to look at our diplomatic relations with that state. I think the rest of Europe has to look at its diplomatic relations for as long as this war crime is being allowed to be perpetrated.
There was a piece, John O'Brien, not in today's papers, but in yesterday's Guardian, highlighting how it was in the view of unnamed diplomats in Brussels that the Irish and the Spanish governments had created a space for other European leaders in which they could start to change their minds about Gaza. Has that been the importance of the Irish position?
I think it has. The European Union, I think, was placed in a very difficult position by Ursula von der Leyen. Remember that after the 7th of October, she unilaterally took the decision to put the Star of David on the Berlaymont building, the Commission's building in Brussels. A week later, she went to Israel and she said, "I am unequivocally on the side
of
Israel."
And there was no calls for restraint.
Her position hasn't really changed. But the really interesting thing this week was that after the deaths of those seven aid workers, three of them British, Joe Biden finally got on the phone to Netanyahu, and he said this has to stop. And within hours, the Israelis opened two border crossings that they had resolutely refused to open over the previous months.
But with the other hand, Joe Biden is still sending them arms.
I'm not giving him any credit, Philip. I think he's behaved disgracefully throughout this, and I just can't understand that how a man who seems to have faith at the center of everything he does, that he could have put up with this for so long and given succor to Netanyahu and the people who are committing this.
I don't want to disagree with John, but I think Biden has been trying. I think he's been utterly ineffectual in trying to persuade Netanyahu, but I think he has been trying for humanitarian approaches with absolutely no effect. He has achieved.
And by the way, this is the 30th.
And he won't until he stops selling
arms.
We're
at the 30th anniversary of the Rwanda genocide, which took place in April, after the 6th of April 1994. The Americans at that time, for months, refused to let their diplomats call it a genocide. Even when there were hundreds of thousands of people dead, Warren Christopher, the then Secretary of State, instructed the ambassador at the UN that under no circumstances could they call it a genocide, because they would have been compelled to act.
Let me just bring in one brief moment of levity before we move on. Aisling Maloney, you noted Nathan Carter really taking a very risky position on Beyonce.
Yes, indeed. So Beyonce has released a new album, and it's called Cowboy Carter, and it's a country album by Beyonce. People might have heard her her song already, but she has covered Jolene Dolly Parton's famous song, and she has changed it. She's left in the iconic guitar lick.
But Nathan is taking issue with her
happy,
interpretation.
Not unhappy with her interpretation. He said he doesn't like it. It wouldn't be my cup of tea. But he added it was a good thing that their country record is bringing attention to country music. But
does
of course,
he not realise that nobody anywhere at any point in the history of the last 30 years was going to have profited by taking on Beyonce?
Yes, exactly. But also, I mean, he made all his money from Wagon Wheel, which is a cover of Bob Dylan's work. So, look.
That's very true.
So there you go. Beyonce, but he says he doesn't like it.
Beyonce's album is stunning. Give me Cowboy stunning. Carter over Nathan Carter any day of the week.
Oh my God. I would agree.
What can of worms have you opened there? What can of worms has Fergus Finlay opened on me? Earlier on, we were discussing today's Sunday Independent Ireland Thinks poll. Fergus questioned the methodology of the text-based poll. Ireland Thinks have been in touch to defend their approach. They say a panel of 25,000, from which Fergus is probably going to be ejected now, is drawn from random sampling from telephone polls with demographic gaps plugged by targeted advertising. Each month, a perfectly representative group of 4,000 are selected to take part on the basis of their age, gender, religiosity, region, political interest and past voting behaviour. A Pew Research study identified this as the most accurate way to do polling, and our estimates have been very accurate, for example, when it came to vaccine take-up on the recent referendum on the night of the vote. It was set up by Dr. Kevin Cunningham, an Oxford-trained statistician who works as a consultant on methodology for four other UK firms as well.
And I'm reassured, Philip, absolutely good. Reassured, 100% reassured.
You could take that away, put it in your pipe and look at next.
That took nearly
Ireland
as long as my explanation on housing. By the way.
I take that back and I apologise to you as well. All right, folks, thank you very much, John O'Brennan, Aisling Meehan, Aisling Maloney and Fergus Finlay.